Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, August 28, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, our weekly discussion on what's making headlines and the stories behind them. We're coming to you today from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. We've got a lot coming your way this next half hour, including the end of a partnership between ESPN and Frontline. The two had been working for months on a documentary set to air in October on the NFL's handling of traumatic brain injuries. League brass reportedly put pressure on ESPN to drop the project, and it did. Folks at Frontline say they're going forward with the documentary, and it will air on PBS stations this fall, but it's again calling into question ESPN's role as journalists. A quick change to many journalism style guides. Last week, just as we prepared to record our program, we found out Bradley Manning was sentenced to 35 years in prison. The very next day, an announcement on NBC's Today Show came out that he wanted to be referred to as Chelsea Manning going forward and was asking media outlets to respect that decision and make all references using female pronouns going forward. For many journalists, it was the first time a newsmaker, already familiar to their audiences, had made such a request, leading to confusion on how to respond in the moment. And Sunday night, millions of people tuned into the Video Music Awards on MTV, anticipating the NSYNC reunion. They got that, but they also saw what could only be described as an over-the-top performance from pop singers Miley Cyrus and Robin Thicke. That in and of itself isn't really news, but it sparked a conversation on what is news and what's just simply clickbait. We'll look at how viral content is changing online journalism standards. That's just a taste of what's ahead. We've got some other topics we want to touch on as well, but let's start by talking about more of this League of Denial, a joint project between Frontline and ESPN examining the impact of head injuries on current and former NFL players. The two-hour documentary has been in the works for more than 15 months. Its trailer promises to change the way you look at the game of football.
The brain is riddled with disease. That was pretty ominous.
Frontline investigates what the NFL knew and when they knew it.
We can't go against the NFL. They'll squash you. We'll burn this town tonight.
Yeah.
I'm really wondering where this stops. I'm really wondering if every single football player doesn't have this.
The documentary is expected to be a narrative along the same lines of so many of the news reports we've seen over the past decade. The league shutting its eyes to evidence that players are sustaining brain trauma on the field that could lead to severe long-term cognitive disability. It's based on the reporting of two ESPN reporters, Steve Faneru and his brother Mark Faneru-Wada. The Frontline team joined in, and together they're said to present a pretty complete picture from the perspective of players, family members, doctors, pathologists, equipment manufacturers, the list goes on. It remains unclear why ESPN is backing out exactly. The Disney-owned sports network says it ended the partnership with Frontline because it wasn't comfortable with the level of editorial control it felt it had, or more that it should have had, over the production, and claims broadcast rights that they have currently to pro football have nothing to do with it. But according to a report in the New York Times, there were witnesses to a meeting at a Manhattan restaurant that turned contentious between ESPN brass and league officials, including Commissioner Roger Goodell. People described the meeting as combative, with the league folks showing irritation with the documentary's direction. The NFL denies trying to sway ESPN in any way and says the network was the people who called the meeting. We've been asking this before. What is ESPN's role in a situation like this?
I mean, they have a very divided situation going on there, trying to maintain a division between their news operation. And frankly, they have some very good sports reporters, and they have a very good investigative sports program. And then the moneymaker for them, which is pro football, college football especially. And I don't see how it's possible to maintain that bright line, not have a conflict of interest like this crop up on regularly, frankly.
I think one of the issues that people really need to understand is that when ESPN was first founded, it was about entertainment and turning sports into entertainment. And I think what you're seeing here is that that's exactly what they're doing. And they've always been about the entertainment side of sports more so than the journalism. I think the journalism part of it gives them some credibility and some cachet. But unlike CBS or NBC that have sports divisions and then have news where there's a clear separation, ESPN has always had this problem of where does the entertainment part come into play and then the journalism. And they always tend to side with the entertainment.
So on the Links blog, you can take a look at a full statement that the president of ESPN issued in regards to this and maintains again and again and again the NFL had nothing to do with this decision and claims that the network has been quite aggressive in its coverage of concussions in football players. Is there a validity to that? Has it been that aggressive?
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt for a moment. Not that I really believe the NFL had nothing to do with it, but let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. What does that say about ESPN if they're concerned at the last minute, maybe a month or so out from the airing of this documentary, oh, we didn't have enough editorial control? The ombudsman for ESPN wrote an interesting column where he talked to the head of ESPN and he said this promo that you just played, basically, it surprised them. They didn't know when it was released publicly to the media that it was going to look like that, and it was over the top and sensational. If ESPN didn't have any controls going into that, that says something bad about them, and I'm more likely to believe that it had less to do with, oh, we don't have editorial control, but we're worried now that the league is really leaning on us.
I'm also concerned about the whole over-the-top thing. I mean, because if you watch ESPN programming, both in its journalism content as well as in its entertainment, it's all over the top. So for them to be surprised by this, I just find that startling. And after watching that promo, and this is the third time I've seen it, I don't see what's so over the top about it.
So this is actually not the first time. The league is denying emphatically that it tried to lean on ESPN in this matter. But it's not the first time. You guys remember the show Playmakers?
Right. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Right. I mean, that was the same incident. But then again, you have the Playmakers show where the NFL stepped in and said, whoa, wait a minute. This is a little bit risque, and it's causing us some problems here. And ESPN backed off on that. They also went after HBO in certain instances of the show in which they were running. With particular football teams. So, I mean, there's a history of the NFL doing this, and it's all about control and this control of image. The NFL brand is probably, in sports television today, the most high-profile, big-ticket profit brand that's out there, and Roger Goodell and NFL officials are going to do everything they can to keep it that way.
And I think, too, Amy, if you want to look at another clue as to what ESPN's motivations are that really is sort of disturbing, they have had great journalists, and Outside the Lines has been a very good sports program. The reporters who are part of this documentary and who are writing a book are ESPN reporters. But Outside the Lines is being moved. It's been on Sunday mornings on ESPN, and they have a decent audience. They have moved it to ESPN2 for the football season and putting it on an earlier time. So they're demoting the very people that they claim are doing all this great work for them.
And the fact that those people who were doing that work weren't consulted about this shift in policy away from the cooperation with Frontline. And from all the reports that we have, ESPN sought out Frontline because of its news credibility. And for them to turn around and come back and say, whoa, wait a minute, we're going to sever that tie a month and a half before this thing is supposed to air, It really hurts ESPN's credibility.
Well, so let's talk about Frontline for a second. This is kind of an MO we've seen from that organization happening a lot in the not-so-recent past, partnering with ProPublica, partnering with the New York Times. Even a few years ago when I was back working at the Chicago Tribune, helped facilitate a partnership for a program called Jesus in China that they had done with a reporter based there at the time. Is this the type of a thing that could create a chilling effect for Frontline to say, we're not going to want to partner with someone that's going to back out on us at the last minute?
I mean, this is the first one that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And frankly, I mean, ESPN's reputation is so strong that those other partners you've mentioned, like ProPublica, NPR, other folks that have been involved with them, are going to want to continue that kind of partnership. It's mutually beneficial for these news organizations to be collaborating on audience building.
But I think what's going to happen here is that they're going to be very careful about getting involved with organizations like an ESPN in the future for fear that this could happen again. I mean, there should have been some sort of procedure, some sort of documentation in place to prohibit this from happening, especially at this late date.
Okay. Well, either way, the documentary will air on most PBS stations beginning October 8. You can already watch some segments of it on the Frontline website. We've linked you through to see some of those via our links blog at kbia.org. There was another story that came out this week about ESPN, looking at college football and what a big business it is and the role that ESPN plays in college football. We're here at an SEC school. We probably don't see it any clearer than we do right here in our own backyards.
We're in the SEC probably as much as anything because of the money that ESPN brings to the table with the SEC network. I don't think the story itself necessarily brought out any new information, but the fact that it was a lengthy treatment in the New York Times says something about how many people are going to know about it. I mean, it went into everything from how ESPN basically has caused schools to switch conferences, how some conferences, I think the Mountain West was one of them, it sort of collapsed because Boise State moved away to get a better deal from ESPN. They really do control a lot of what happens in college football.
Well, I think this story, the one that the New York Times has been running over the course of the last couple of days, is probably more complete about the power of ESPN than the topic we just talked about involving Frontline. I mean, ESPN in college football and college basketball has been able to basically coerce schools into moving into, as Mike said, into certain conferences, but it also controls the schedule. And that's the huge thing. Whereas Saturday used to be college football basically from in the morning until at night, now you've got college football on Saturdays, you've got it on Friday nights, you've got it
Thursdays
on Thursdays,
too,
you got it on Wednesday. So now it's sort of they have basically been able to convince these schools that if you're willing to move your college football game to this night, we can give you national exposure that you couldn't get anywhere else. And schools have bought into that.
Well, and if you look at the Mizzou football schedule just for this season, the first 3 weeks are set, but you almost don't know what time a game is going to be until the week of, because it's all based on television.
The athletic departments are willing to make that exchange because they really are getting a lot more money for being involved with ESPN and conferences associated with them.
And the thing about it is, it's not just, I mean, ESPN is the big dog in the game right now, but you also have CBS has jumped into it, NBC has jumped into it, Fox has jumped into it in a big way. So it's not just going to be ESPN that's going to be dictating what these colleges are doing. It's also going to be all the networks, because college football and college basketball are big businesses, and you can't run your athletic programs without bringing in that revenue from those two sports.
Okay. Well, last Wednesday, we were talking about David Miranda's detention at the London airport when, Mike, you mentioned in passing that as part of that discussion, we had just learned Bradley Manning, the Army private convicted of leaking documents to the website WikiLeaks, had just been sentenced to 35 years in a military prison. As is usually the case in a big story like this, the morning news programs clamored for the first interview with his attorney. NBC's Today Show won out, but little did people there know the news that was about to break on their air.
Let's talk about Mr. Manning personally, and he has provided a statement that he wants us to read, and this is part of it. As I transition into this next phase of my life, I want everyone to know the real me. I am Chelsea Manning. I am a female. Given the way that I feel and have felt since childhood, I want to begin hormone therapy as soon as possible. I also request that starting today, you refer to me by my new name and use the feminine pronoun. Why did she choose this moment to announce this?
Well, Chelsea didn't want to have this be something that overshadowed the case. Wanted to wait until the case was done to move forward to the next stage of her life.
That request from Chelsea Manning left journalists to question what to do in the moment. Honor her request or stick with the legal name. As you could see there, today's show anchor, Savannah Guthrie, immediately switched over, referring to Chelsea using her preferred name and female pronouns. Other media wasn't as quick to respond. In some cases, news organizations chose to stick with Bradley. Others used both names, using Bradley on first reference and Chelsea later. Either way, the change felt a little clumsy to the casual reader. It took a few days to sort out, but now it seems there are some new editorial policies in place. The Associated Press has issued an advisory to editors and subscribers saying it would, quote, henceforth use private Chelsea E. Manning and female pronouns for the soldier formerly known as Bradley Manning, and in accordance with her wishes to live as a woman. The New York Times says it will refer to Chelsea Manning with a mention that she is formerly known as PFC Bradley Manning and she will be a she. On the flip side, editors at the Washington Post said it will continue to refer to Manning as a he because this is an ongoing story and readers identify strongly with Bradley Manning from the past coverage. Were you guys surprised about the kind of the turnaround and not knowing quite what to do?
No, I'm not really surprised at all. I think you're going to see this sort of flip-flop back and forth because it's newspapers and media organizations are going to have to determine, are you going to present this story to your audience or in the way in which they understand it, or are you going to present it to adhere to the wishes of the person that you're writing about? And it's going to go back and forth until the editors make a decision which way they're going to go. And I think AP has decided this is what we're going to do. But as you can see from the New York Times and the Washington Post, they're leaving themselves a caveat, you know, a way out if there's a better way to put it.
You know, I can make a case for any one of those policies that have been announced that they all have some logical sense behind them. I kind of actually liked what Savannah Guthrie did. We didn't see all of it here on the show, but if you go to our blog, you'll see it. The whole interview with the attorney up until they got to the part about the genders, which she referred to him as Bradley Manning and he. But once they got into that topic, she very smoothly moved into calling, you know, her Chelsea. So I don't have a problem with that. And I actually agree with the notion that when you're referring to past episodes like the court martial and all of that, maybe it is appropriate to use Bradley Manning and he. But after that, I don't have any problem with calling her what she wants to be called.
No, I think Mike's absolutely right. I mean, if you're going to talk about it from now and into the future, then you need to, if Chelsea wants to be referred to as Chelsea, then that's what you're going to do. Yeah.
It's interesting. This came up in some of our classes and as we would talk to students. And we saw how working journalists covering the story in the moment paused and spent some time thinking about it. Generally speaking, our students didn't bat an eye and immediately said, why not just go with Chelsea right then and there? Is it a generational thing?
I think partly so, and it kind of tracks what we know about the attitudes among younger people about marriage equality, for example. I mean, there's just no question at all. I mean, I asked the question in our class when a student brought it up for discussion, and every single student who spoke up said, absolutely, call her what she wants to be called. This is not a hard issue. So I think there is a generational.
Well, I think it's generational, but I also think it's the way in which we actually teach our students and mm-hmm. we train them about the fact that the story is not about the journalists. It's about the people that you're talking to, and it's about them and their story and how they live their lives. And if this is the way Chelsea wants to live her life, then that's the way you need to present it. And it's easier for them to sort of embrace that than it is for past generations.
We have been talking a lot about coverage in the New York Times today, and that just kind of happened inadvertently. But it's interesting, given most people haven't been able to access the New York Times website for the better part of the last 24 hours or so. The Syrian Electronic Army, a group backing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, took down the site in the middle of the afternoon yesterday on Tuesday in what some are calling a pretty creative way. It literally stole the web address from the domain registrar. Mike, can you explain exactly how that happened, what that means?
Well, I mean, the internet is really a variety of different nodes, including these name registrars that maintain the equivalence between the IP address, the numerical address for every computer that's on the internet and the named addresses like nytimes.com. And so this was a very sophisticated attack to get at the name server level, as opposed to, say, hacking in, as we talked to last week, about going through Outbrain or going through Twitter or something like that. The level of sophistication here is really stunning and somewhat disturbing, because the New York Times has been on and off now for the past maybe 16, 18 hours. It wasn't just for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
No. Matter of fact, it's still off now. I mean, as we speak.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get on right before we taped the show, and it was down again. But it was up this morning. So I think that they're starting to see a series of attacks, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was started by this particular organization, but others have sort of joined in saying, hey, you know, if they can do it, we can do it too. So,
well, and there is a publicly available backup site, if you will, and we do have a link on our links blog to the New York Times reporting and explanation as to what's going on that goes to that backup site. So there is a way to get to it that way.
Of course, the bigger question, as you know, is that this is only one of many recent examples, and not just of this one organization that's backing the Assad regime. The Chinese government and others have been accused of hacking news sites and bringing them down, and it's a big, big problem. In fact, the chief information officer for Thomson Reuters, which runs the Reuters News Service, is going to be here on campus in a couple of weeks talking specifically about whether or not we can figure out technical ways to provide more cybersecurity for news organizations. This is really threatening both the bottom line and the ability to communicate effectively with audiences.
Well, especially when you start talking about the bottom line, as you have more and more news sites that are going to the paywall model. If people can't get on, then they're going to want their money back. And are they going to want it for that day? Are they going to want it for just the time period? I mean, how do you fix that? I mean, especially when you have sites that are up and down, you lose your credibility when people can't get on.
Okay, well, Sunday night, were either of you guys watching the VMAs on MTV?
Well, I was watching Breaking Bad, and I hate to say this, but American Ninja Warrior. But I did switch over and watch what you're about
to
talk
about. Well, then I'll cop to it. I may or may not have been watching a Real Housewives program on Bravo. I can tell you, though, the people who were watching MTV saw quite the musical act put on by pop singers Miley Cyrus and Robin Thicke. Radio audience, we can't begin to describe the video we're showing right now. Can't even begin to. It was over the top, with larger-than-life teddy bears, foam fingers, and sexually provocative dance moves. Viewers were shocked, and before it even ended, snippets showed up online. By morning, it had moved beyond water cooler talk. It was the lead on several morning newscasts and websites. CNN.com was one of those, featuring it very prominently on its homepage, teasing the story with a headline that read, "Miley Cyrus did what?" And the story beside it? It was about Secretary of State John Kerry citing evidence that Syria had used chemical weapons on its own people. That editorial decision caught the eye of people over at The Onion, and it published a fake op-ed under the byline of Meredith Artley, CNN.com's real managing editor, along with the headline, "Let me explain why Miley Cyrus's VMA performance was our top story this morning." Writing as Artley, The Onion said, quote, "It's a good question, and the answer is pretty simple. It was an attempt to get you to click on CNN.com so that we could drive up our web traffic, which in turn would allow us to increase our advertising revenue." Granted, Artley didn't actually write the piece, but it still raises a legitimate question. How have our standards changed when it comes to what we call news and how we play it, just to serve the bottom line?
It's sensationalism. And you can see it throughout the history of journalism. If there's a story out there that's going to get eyeballs, that people are going to want to read, they put it out there. And it'll lead a newscast. It'll be at the top of the fold of a newspaper. It's going to be at the top of the website. And this is what people were talking about. And they picked up on it right away and they ran with it.
In some senses, it's funny. In other senses, it's very serious. Meredith Artley, by the way, is a proud alum of the Missouri School
of
Journalism.
Program. And not only that, was our commencement speaker in May.
Right. And you know, when you read that at first, and some people came away thinking, did she write this or was The Onion satirizing her? Because, you know, there were a lot of points
there. I had to do a double
take.
It was a very good satirization.
I had to do a double take.
When I was reading it, I mean, that line that you just quoted, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, now, you probably wouldn't see a news executive actually admit that, not in an open forum, but that is exactly what they did.
You know, I've got to say, though, I wouldn't pick on CNN, at least not exclusively.
Oh, no, not
everybody was on this story. It was on social media. And frankly, the VMAs, everybody expects something like this. We had Madonna and The Kiss, and you can go back and name all kinds
Lady
of
Lady Gaga doing crazy stuff.
All of that
stuff.
But this is how MTV and the VMAs basically made their mark in American pop culture, was by doing these types of things. So for anybody to be surprised that it happened,
there's no reason to be surprised.
But I think the over-the-topness of what she was doing and the provocative nature in which she did it is what probably drew a lot of people to it.
I think there is the difference from the fact that she was at least seen by many people who could have been watching that show. And there are lots of teens and preteens who I'm sure were watching it who remember Miley Cyrus, right?
Hannah Montana.
And so some parents might even be more disturbed by sort of the sexual nature of it because it was her. Madonna, we would come to expect that from her or other rock stars. But again, in the end, MTV does this all the time. We've come to expect it. The media, we're looking for it. The only thing that was surprising is that maybe that this overwhelmed the NSYNC reunion, as you mentioned in the lead-in, which
was
really was not
waiting
much.
For. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to take a few minutes to quickly follow up on some of the stories we've discussed recently. Last week, we talked about the launch of Al Jazeera America. Bit more than a week in, and most of the updates I'm getting about the new cable news network have been pretty positive. My parents up in the Chicagoland area have access, and they say they like what they see. Mike, you've got an update for us regarding your own cable provider.
It took me about 6 days of inquiry before CenturyLink actually told me what I needed to do, which was to pay about $5 a month more just for that channel. And you can also get it on Dish and DirecTV here in Columbia. On Mediacom, you can't. But my impression, and I've only watched it now for like a day and a half, it's pretty much as you say. It's very straightforward, old school news. There's not a lot of sensationalism. When they talked about Miley Cyrus, for example, they did it in the context of having dueling experts talking about whether or not this was objectification of young women and what that meant. So that's about how they got into it, a very issue-oriented broadcast. So far, kind of maybe stuffy, but in some ways, in a very positive way. I enjoyed watching it just because it's so different from what you're seeing on MSNBC, Fox, and CNN.
Yeah, I've watched it for about 3 days now, and I get it on DirecTV, and I think Mike is absolutely right. I mean, it's straight down the middle, about as much as straight down the middle as you can get in television these days. But the thing I like about it is that the international reporting is very good, especially when you're talking about the issues that are going on in Egypt and in Syria. You get much more of a contextual view of what's going on if it's watching Al Jazeera than you do watching the network programs.
My only problem is that's their strength. And if you ever watched Al Jazeera English online, you look forward to some of those stories. But Al Jazeera America is downplaying their international expertise because they're trying to cater to an American audience and not be perceived as, you know, different, weird, anti-American.
Okay, well, we are also quickly approaching the Labor Day weekend, and the kerfuffle continues between Time Warner Cable and CBS. Subscribers in 8 major television markets have been without CBS or a handful of other stations it owns for the better part of 3 weeks. They're fighting over subscriber fees. Time Warner lobbed another bomb in that ongoing feud, emailing its customers offering free antennas so subscribers could watch CBS programming for free over the air. So any predictions from you guys on when this is going to finally end? Is it football next weekend?
I think it's football next weekend. I think it's the new shows that are coming in. I think this is going to end pretty quickly.
Okay, well, like always, we're out of time before we're out of things to talk about. Thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background for today's topics on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show, leave comments for us there, especially as it relates to Al Jazeera, if you have been getting it and what your thoughts are on it. Send us an email, too, at views at kbia.org. RJS Travis McMillan is our director, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. The three of us will be here for another edition of Views of the News.